We're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the World Cafe throughout the month of October, digging up the best of our archived interviews. And today we focus on our favorites from blues and gospel. Look forward to Buddy Guy, R.L. Burnside, and Mavis Staples later this hour. To kick things off, it's Coco Taylor, who clearly earned her nickname Queen of the Blues. A powerful singer, she was born on a sharecropper's farm in Tennessee, but was discovered by producer Willie Dixon. Dixon got her a recording contract with Chess and produced several singles and two albums for her, including the song that launched her to fame in 1965, Wang Dang Doodle. Before she passed away in 2009, Taylor won more W.C. Handy Blues Awards than any other woman in history. When Coco Taylor stopped by in 1994 for an interview with the Cafe's Michaela Majune, she had just released Force of Nature. She began by playing Don't Put Your Hands on Me off that disc.
Don't you put your hands on me. And that's why they call her the Queen of the Blues. And this is not a woman who put in time as the Princess of the Blues. She went right to the throne. Who gave you that title originally?
Well, the Queen of the Blues came from my fans. You know, everybody just starts saying, you are definitely the Queen of the Blues. And I guess they start saying that because they could feel what I do. And I always felt like you first got to put something in to get something out. It's like putting money in the bank. If you don't put no money in there, you ain't got nothing to draw out. So I always try to sing where people can feel what I'm doing, and I think that's why they gave me that title, because they could feel it coming from the heart, because I'm definitely doing what I enjoy doing most, and that's singing the blues.
Now, when you were growing up in Memphis, you were singing gospel music originally, right?
Yeah, I grew up singing gospel, because my dad said everybody in his house had to go to church on Sunday, and we did. I went to church on Sunday, sang gospel on Sunday, and blues on Monday.
So you were singing blues already, so they weren't upset.
No, I wasn't recording. I wasn't doing that
right.
Kind of singing. But I would sneak behind the house because my brother made himself a guitar out of some hay bale and wire. My younger brother made him a harmonica out of a corn cob, and I didn't need no mic. We just started jamming behind our house, and that's what we did. And we'd sing the blues, play the blues. So we kept a good thing going on all the time around that house, other than gospel.
So you were kind of doing that on the sly. Was your family upset when you came out as a professional singer of the blues?
Well, they was kind of upset at first, but they ain't upset no more.
And why is that?
Well, I tell you, they was like a lot of other folks. We don't like the blues, but they like what the blues buy. So that made them happy.
Who were you listening to on the radio at that time when you were growing up?
Well, I used to listen to Bessie Smith, Big Mama Thornton, Muddy Waters, Sonny Boy Williams, and you know, just a whole bunch of everybody, you know. It was really a great inspiration to me because I always thought they was the greatest people in the world. And I used to hear them on WDIA down there with Rufus Thomas in Memphis. And at that time, B.B. King was the DJ over in West Memphis, Arkansas, which was just across the bridge from Memphis, you know. And they would always play the blues, and I look forward every day listening to that program because I knew what I was going to be listening to, you know.
Did you ever think in those days that you'd be playing with somebody like B.B. King?
No, I never thought I would be playing with nobody. Matter of fact, you know, it was like a dream come true when, you know, I found out that I was going to be out here doing it, you know, but it's a good feeling.
Now, Coco, when you visited the World Cafe before, when you were on that Alligator Records tour, you mentioned that you didn't move to Chicago to become a singer or a recording star. You moved because the only work you could get around Memphis was picking cotton, and you wanted to look for a better life.
Right. So me and my husband, Pop Taylor, we left Memphis with no money out of our pocket and a box of Ritz crackers between us, and we headed to Chicago. When we got to 63rd Street and saw all them lights, I said, good God, this must be heaven. But it didn't take long for me to find out I'm still a long ways away. But anyway, we went there to better our condition, like finding a good job and all that kind of stuff, you know, and which we did. So,
what kind of work did you find when you got there?
Well, for me, I found what they call domestic work, but that's the fancy modern name. It's just plain old house cleaning, of course. And, you know, I just went on doing that until I was discovered by Willie Dixon. And this was one of the times that I was sitting in with, you know, some of the local blues bands around Chicago, South Side, like the Howlin' Wolf, you know. And when I came down from sitting up on the bandstand just jamming for my own enjoyment, he came over and he says, my God, I never heard a woman sing the blues like you sang the blues. He said, we got a lot of men's out here doing it, but no women's. And this is what the world needs today, a woman like you to sing the blues. I said, here I am. And I've been singing the blues ever since. He wrote for me my first song, got me started on my way on Chess Records. And he wrote Wang Dang Doodle for me. And when I found out that Wang Dang Doodle had hit the top of the charts all over the country, I says, no, this got to be a dream. You know, this ain't happening to me. you know. But anyway, it turned out it was me, and it was for real, you know. I've been singing the blues ever since. We talking almost right at 30 years now.
When Willie Dixon approached you that night, did you know who he was?
I had never saw the man before in my life, but he was really a good person to meet, a good person to work with, and he was like my right arm. And when he passed away, you know, that's the way I felt, like I had lost my right arm there, you know, because we had worked together so close for so many years.
Now, before you recorded Wang Dang Doodle, you recorded another album, right? You didn't even know he was recording you?
Well, no, actually, he didn't do it. We was down in his basement, and this was for Victoria Spivey, which lived in New York, and I'm down in the basement with Sonny Land Slim and Johnny Shine and you know, all these people, and we just jamming, having a good time. I didn't know nothing about we was recording. So later on, when I saw the album, and so I had did something on this record, I'm going like, when did I do this? You know, it was all a surprise, you know.
Well, you've got to do Wang Dang Doodle after that lead-in.
Well, Blues Machines, how about the Wang Dang Doodle? Y'all, I mean, it's daytime, you know. You see, in the first place, the Blues Machines ain't used to playing the blues while the sun's shining. They used to playing the blues at night. But we're going to go ahead and do it for everybody. We're going to pitch a Wang Dang Doodle.
On the World Cafe, Wang Dang Doodle, the daytime version. That was really great.
Yeah, the sun's shining. We usually do this one at night.
There's another thing about the blues, too. I mean, people who sing the blues sometimes come across as tough on some songs. Is that who you are?
I'm not tough. I'm very timid. You know.
Your band is disagreeing with you here, Coco.
Well, I mean, you know, that's because they are men. And I'm the leader. And, you know, don't no man want to take orders from a woman. So that's the reason why they grunting and cleaning the throat up and everything over there. But one thing about it, I got good guys, though. They cleaning the throat up. But really, you know, they love being with me and I love being with them. And we stick together. We work together like one big happy family. When they get off a track, I just spank them and put them back on track and keep on going.
We won't get into that anymore. Speaking of spanking, do you have any children?
Yes, I do, but not no little ones no more.
There's a song on your album. By the way, did you used to write songs back when you started? Because you've written a few.
Yes, I did. I wrote a song called "What Kind of Man Is This?" Good God Almighty! And I was writing about my husband at that time because. You know, I didn't know nothing else to write about. I said, well, you're just good as any, you know, anything else to write about. And that's what I started writing about.
Well, on this album, on your latest album, you have a song called 63-Year-Old Mama.
No, I'm not 63 years old.
I didn't think so, but but you have a line where you say, I'm just as young as I feel. And that sounds like it comes from the heart.
Now we talking. Feel like I'm 21. Now we talking.
It seems like you're going strong as ever stronger, so you're probably not thinking about not doing this in a few years, about retiring.
I'm not even thinking on retiring. I'm thinking about keep on doing what I'm doing and hang in there. You know, the sky's the limit. You know, if I land somewhere in the clouds, fine with me, but I'll still be doing it as long as God give me my health and strength. And when I get so I'm not able to do it, then I have no choice to retire. But until then, y'all will be seeing me out here singing the blues.
Coco Taylor recorded back in 1994. She passed away in 2009. Thanks to Michaela Majun for that interview. After the break, our gospel and blues show continues with two masters of the guitar, very different players, Buddy Guy and R.L. Burnside. Hear that in a moment on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe. I'm David Dye. This is a special 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe on the blues. We'll get to an unbelievable live performance recorded with R.L. Burnside in 2000. But first, an excerpt from our 2005 interview with Buddy Guy. Chicago blues band Buddy Guy got his start in the 1950s Baton Rouge, Louisiana scene. A guitar player's guitar player, he could count Stevie Ray Vaughan, Eric Clapton, and Jimi Hendrix among his fans. After decades of touring and recording, Guy had a hit with his 1991 album, the Grammy Award-winning disc, Damn Right I've Got the Blues. Around the time of this interview in 2005, Guy was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and released the album Bring 'Em In. When we sat down together, I began by asking Buddy Guy about the very start of his career and why he moved to Baton Rouge as a teen.
I went into Baton Rouge because our grade school was over in Letchwood, and there was no high school. And my mother and father were sharecroppers, and my oldest sister was working at LSU. And she said, well, send him here. At least he'll get a high school education. And I got there, and about, I guess, 3 to 4 months, my mother taking a stroke, and that was the end of my education and so forth as that. But they had the Lightning Slim and the Slim Hoppos there in Baton Rouge, and I wanted to be closer to my mom, which Baton Rouge is about halfway between New Orleans and where I was born at. You have to drive through there to get up in there. Mm. And after she taking a stroke, of course, being the oldest boy, I didn't want to get too far from her anyway.
And you started playing with somebody who passed away not so long ago, Rafael Neal.
Actually, I started with a guy by the name of Big Papa. He didn't have a name for himself, but he came, got me from a service station. I was pumping gas, and I was too shy to sing, and I played for him at the service station. He said, well, I can pay you as much as you're making at the service station, and you probably could go to school in the daytime, and I accepted that, but I was having a lot of migraines. Then I think I was about 17, and I just couldn't go to school and do those nights, which was around sometime I think I made 50 cents, 65 cents a night or something like that.
Wow.
I could go a long ways with that, though.
Yeah.
I think a gallon of gas was 21 cents.
At it now. Let's talk a little. We were talking before we got on the air here about your new album, which I think sounds just fantastic, primarily for me, because you sound great playing on it. It's called Bring 'Em In. And you were talking a little bit about how, you know, the blues purists might be a little bit of a backlash because of some of the material. There's a, you know, Bob Dylan song on here, Johnny Taylor tune, Otis Redding. But I've also heard you say you used to go into bars when you started playing and saying, I'm here to play your jukebox for you. And the jukebox would have all kinds of different stuff on it.
They would make you go audition if you didn't, wasn't the Muddy Waters or Otis Rush, or somebody had a record where you could say, play this. So it was a lot of us at the club heard about you, and they said, well, okay, coming in at 1 o'clock tomorrow evening and audition. So when you would go in that audition with your three or four pieces, they would say, well, okay, here it is. They would give you those top 10 records on the jukebox, and that wasn't just no blues, man. That's why I said earlier we got branded with that. That was like Lloyd Price, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, you know, and even some of the doo-wops tunes was being played on there. So if you could handle at least 8 or 9 of those most played on that jukebox, the guy would say, well, okay, you can come in here and play. Didn't nobody know who you were when you first started off? And I would tell some of the club owners, I would say, hey, if you let me play in there, Muddy Waters will stop by. This is like a club. Muddy don't play. This is all up springing up everywhere. And they say, oh, man, you don't know Muddy Waters. I say, okay, well, I'll give you a try. I ain't going to pay you nothing. But if you think you can bring Muddy Waters, you know, you come in Wednesday night and play. So I would tell Muddy, you know, could you stop by the Wolf? Oh, yeah, we'll stop by there, but it's going to cost you. You know, I said, well, you know, I don't have nothing nowhere. I don't know. I thought I was just joking. So they would come in the bar and sit at the bar, and the owner's mouth would fly wide open, and they would order a couple of bottles of whiskey and put it on my tab and leave and go home. When I get off at night, the owner would look at me and say, well, you know, you did all right. You promised me money, and then they showed up, but you in the red.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Buddy, I just finished reading the Jimi Hendrix biography, which is a pretty good one. And it talks a lot about when Jimmy first went over to England. And I think it's your friend Eric Clapton who at the time said, oh, my God, it's Buddy Guy on acid. And of course, people, if you listen to Jimi Hendrix's playing, you know that he listened to you. And did you ever get a chance to talk with him and have him acknowledge that?
Actually, you know, I came to Newport Jazz, and I think it was this month of 1967. And I was always told that if you don't make New York, you'll never go anywhere. And we played Newport and came into New York, and somebody had a video. And I didn't know who he was, man. And I was, like, kind of wild and crazy, and we were getting away. I had the guitar behind my head and all this crap, and somebody kept whispering, that's Jimi Hendrix, that's Jimi Hendrix. I said, so what? Who is he? You know, and he laughed, and he taped the show, and somebody taped him taping this. And he plugged up, and we jammed, and we got a chance to get acquainted for about 2.5 years before he passed. And I raised hell at him. I raised hell at Janis Joplin. But they would always look at me and say, you'll never make it because you got to – you know, you got to get on this train, which they did. I don't know if you saw this Festival Express. And they was calling this, like, get on this train, man, because you got to, you know, you get high. I said, I don't need to get high, man. I get high on my music, you know. And then Muddy and them had taught me how to drink a little wine because that's all we could afford then. And I had some long talks with him. But they was, you know, everybody in the 60s had their own way. And if you got a problem now with eating too much or drinking too much, you have to do that. You have to correct yourself. Can't nobody else make you do that. Your mind have to be made up to say, I got enough of this and I can see where I'm going. Because when I got, into Chicago, I saw a lot of jazz cats getting high. And I saw them just fade away with the goodness they had was leaving them because they was like, I guess they was feeling like they was doing as well as they was before they played. Because I tell people now, I say, you know, I've drank enough about twice in my life to really get drunk. And I don't think I could have learned how to play if I'd have been drinking when I was teaching myself how to play guitar. So I use common sense and say, this you putting in your body might make you think you're doing all right, but it's not. You know, just keep a sober head and listen to what you're doing, and you will probably say to yourself, you know, what Buddy told me, he was right.
Buddy Guy. That interview was recorded in 2005, the same year Mississippi Hill Country blues man R.L. Burnside passed away. But in 2000, we were lucky enough to have him stop by the cafe. Although he played guitar and sang throughout his life, R.L. Burnside primarily made his living as a farmer and a fisherman. That is, until the 1990s, when Fat Possum Records helped give his music career a huge boost. Here he is with his band playing Going Down South.
It's bad, you know. When you have those goods, and they try to slip out on you. I had one like that. But I heard a beat when they hit that bridge. I told her, I'm going with you, baby. I'm going with you, baby. I'm going with you, baby. I don't care where you go. She said, what? I told her again. I'm going with you, baby. I'm going with you, baby. I don't care where.
be so mean.
Son, Mr. Cedric Burnside. Adopted son, Mr. Kenny Brown.
Let My Baby Ride, a live performance from R.L. Burnside, recorded in the World Cafe Studios in 2000. At the time, he had just released Wish I Was in Heaven Sittin' Down. The blues great passed away in 2005. After the break, we get to the gospel portion of our show with the gifted storyteller and singer, Mavis Staples. That's next on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe. To close out this 20th anniversary hour here on the World Cafe, we're joined by gospel great Mavis Staples. Mavis Staples may be best known as the lead singer of the Staples Singers. Led by her father, Pop Staples, the group got their start in the church in the late 1940s. By the 60s, the Staples Singers were touring the South with Dr. King, energizing those in the civil rights movement with freedom songs. By the 1970s, it was the voice of Mavis on hits for the group with songs like Respect Yourself and I'll Take You There. Her 2004 album, Have a Little Faith, re-energized her career. That year, she stopped by the cafe and gave one of our favorite performances and interviews. I started out by asking her if she got her start singing in the church choir.
You know what, David? That is one thing that I was not a part of, the choir. Everybody came out of the choir, all my friends. But you see, when I started, I was too tiny. I was too small. I was 8 years old, you know. And the choir, my older sister, Cleotha, and my brother, Purvis, they were in the choir. See, we had a junior choir. And that, yeah, you had to be a teenager, you know, to be in the choir. So when we started singing, I was I didn't get a chance to sing in the choir. And I've always regretted that, you know, because that was always what I wanted to do.
Well, you spent a lot of time in church, though, right?
Oh, I was in church.
Right.
I was in church from a kid. Every Sunday, we'd go to Sunday school. And then 11 o'clock service, you know, we came up in church.
Mm-hmm.
So and then when Pops started us singing, you know, this is what he taught us, gospel songs. So I've just it's just been my life, you know, minus the choir.
Right. well, you know, and the other thing I was kind of curious about, because Pops moved to Chicago, but did you all ever go down to Mississippi? Did he have folks down there? Did you go visit?
Oh, man, yes. My sister Yvonne and I, you know, it came a time when my mother and father just had too many children, and they couldn't keep us in shoes, you know. So at a time, they would send Yvonne and myself down to Mound Bayou, Mississippi, with my grandmother. And we went to school there, and the summertime, we'd come back to Chicago during the summer. But we had some grand times, and I feel very fortunate that I had that experience, you know, to go down to Mississippi, because that was when I saw the little church on a hill, you know, the little wooden church on a hill,
right,
where there was no instruments, no you know, no organ, no piano, just a wooden floor, and the singing would the whole congregation would sing, and you would hear the patting of your feet and clapping hands, and man, you're talking about a good sound.
That sounds fantastic. Well, you know, the way you described that music, when Pops and you all started singing together, it was just he would play guitar and you all would sing, so it wasn't too far removed from that.
That's right. And he taught us to sing the way his brothers and sisters, our sound. You know, everyone's always said that we had such a unique sound. And that's Pops's family sound. You know, there were 14 of them. Wow. 7 girls and 7 boys. So they had a choir, you know. But
altos, basses, tenors, everybody. Right.
Everybody. And he gave us the voices that they would sing and taught us this, some of the songs that they would sing and the way they sang them. And, of course, you know, then Pops was playing the blues on his guitar.
I would like to get your perspective, because you were in your early 20s, about mm-hmm. about when you and the Staples traveled around with Martin Luther King during the civil rights era, because that is an era I think everybody needs to know as much about as they can. What was your impression? I mean, was that the South that you knew well when you went traveling, or did you see things you didn't expect to see?
Oh, yes. The South was everything that... it is known to be
mm-hmm.
now. Back then, you know,
right.
we had some run-ins. We you know, but we weathered the storm. Pops taught us, you know, to not to start anything,
mm-hmm.
you know, but don't take anything, you know, make you feel less than who you are, you know. But we back in the early 60s, we were down in Montgomery, Alabama, and this was really, really the best thing that happened to us, because it healed all of those wounds that had hurt us back then, you know,
mm-hmm.
to meet Dr. King and to work with him. Pops called us, you know, he knew Dr. King was there in Montgomery, and he called us and said, listen, you all, this man Martin Luther King, you know, he's here, he has church here, and I want to go to his 11 o'clock service. And would you all like to go? And we said, yes, we wanted to go. And after the service, Dr. King would stand at the back door and shake hands with all of the worshipers, you know. And I noticed he and Pop stood there and talked a while. So we got back to the hotel. Pop called us to his room, and he told us, he said, listen, you all, I really like this man's message. I really like what he's doing, and I think if he can preach that, we can sing it.
Hmm.
And we began to write freedom songs. Our first song was March Up Freedom's Highway, and that was for the march from Selma to Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
Then we wrote It's a Long Walk to D.C., but I got my walking shoes on. That was for Washington, D.C. And when will we be paid for the work we've done? I challenge you today. Why Am I Treated So Bad? Why Am I Treated So Bad turned out to be Dr. King's favorite. And every time we worked with him, you know, we would sing first and then Dr. King would speak, you know, and he would always tell Pops, you know, Stape, you're going to sing my song tonight, right? And Pops said, oh, yeah, Doctor, we're going to sing your song. Why Am I Treated So Bad? And Pops wrote that song from watching the news. There were nine black children, and they called the Little Rock Nine. And they were trying to segregate a school down there in Little Rock. And for months, they could not board this bus. No one would let them board the bus. And eventually, on this day, the mayor, the president, the governor, everyone had given these children permission to board the bus. And watching on the news, just as they started to board, a policeman put his billy club across the door. And Pop sit back in his recliner, you know, and he said, now, why are they doing that to him? Why are they treating him so bad? And he wrote that song that evening.
Hmm.
You know, why am I treated so bad? So we really had a wonderful life of singing these songs that we sing. We sang the freedom songs, you know, until we felt that the world was coming together, you know, and we made another transition.
Yeah, I was going to say that the transition into those songs was one, and then you made at least one more, I'd say.
Yes, we did. That was when Respect Yourself and I'll Take You There came. See, we called message songs.
Mm-hmm.
So we began to sing. And then we were singing these songs. You know, we always wanted to reach the youth. And so Pop said, listen, you all, I think if we get us a rhythm section, those children will hear that beat and they will maybe hear what we're saying. You know, because all these years we had just sang with Pop's guitar.
Right.
And we got rhythm section, and we recorded I'll Take You There, Respect Yourself. And these songs went across the board, you know, on the rhythm and blues stations. And all of a sudden, the church people wanted to put us out of church.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, they wanted to. They weren't listening to the lyrics, you know. They just heard the Staple Singers on the rhythm and blues stations, and they just started saying, well, the Staple Singers are singing the devil's music. They're going to the devil, you know. But we had to do so many interviews explaining, you know, I'll take you there. We're talking about taking you to heaven. You know, I know a place. Ain't nobody crying. Ain't nobody worried. Ain't no smiling faces lying to the races. You know, so where else could that be that we're taking you but to heaven?
Mavis Staples is our guest today. Mavis, we talked about it. Can you maybe do a version of I'll Take You There for us?
Oh, sure. Oh. No problem.
Now, can you get away with doing a show without doing this song?
No way. We cannot get off stage without singing I'll Take You There. Hmm. We've tried it. You know, we did it on purpose, you know, so we could get clapped back. You know, we could get encore. But, yeah, we can't leave the stage without doing I'll Take You There. I know a place, y'all, ain't nobody crying, no, ain't nobody worried, no, ain't no smiling faces, no, lying to the races, no, help me, show me on. Somebody help me, him.
I'll take you there.
Oh, help me on.
I'll take you there.
Oh, hey. Help me now.
I'll take you there.
Oh, help me.
I'll take you there.
Oh, mercy.
I'll take you there.
Oh, let me take you there.
I'll take you there.
Let me take you there.
I'll take you there.
Steve, oh, Leo, play your piano now. All right, oh, just do it. Come on now, play on it. Help me, Will. said, Tony, I need you here. Help me out. Come on, Tony.
Yeah.
All right. Dum, 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 dum. Oh, what you doing, stockings? Oh, I know a place, y'all.
I'll take you there.
Oh, ain't nobody crying.
I'll take you there.
Ain't nobody worried.
I'll take you there.
Ain't no smiling faces.
I'll take you there.
No, lying to the races. No,
I'll take you there.
No, 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 no.
I'll take you there.
Woo! Mercy, mercy.
I'll take you there.
Let me take you there.
I'll take you there.
Let me take you there.
I'll take you there.
Let me take you there.
I'll take you there.
Let me take you there.
I'll take you
there.
Hey,
bring it on now. My Lordy, feeling mighty fine. Sure enough, I do. I feel all right, y'all. Yes, I do. I'm feeling pretty good here. Yeah. Sure enough, I do. I'm feeling all right. Oh, goodbye. Yeah. Don't you wanna go? Don't you wanna go?
I'll take you there.
Don't you wanna go?
I'll take you there.
Hey, don't you wanna go?
I'll take you there.
If you do, come on and go with me.
I'll take you there.
Hey, come on and go with me.
I'll take you mm-hmm. there.
If you think you're ready now,
yeah, yeah. I'll take you there.
Come on and go with me.
I'll take you there.
But you gotta be ready, y'all.
I'll take
you must. You gotta be ready, hey.
I'll take
yeah.
you
yeah, yeah.
I'll Take You There by Mavis Staples. That performance was recorded in the World Cafe Studios in 2004. Thanks for joining us on this special 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Additional support provided by the members of the World Cafe affiliates nationwide includes KEOS in College Station, Texas, and KCSN in Los Angeles, California. Shows produced at WXBN from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I'm David Dye. This is The World Cafe.